No matter what you choose to celebrate, the holiday season inspires memories of youth and traditions. Parades such as Macy's in New York and the Tournament of Roses in Pasadena bookend a season marked by lavish displays of decoration and celebration. In this episode, curator William Lawrence Bird will discuss the tradition of American holiday display. We'll not only hear about parades, but also the downtown department store displays that were typical in most American cities in the 20th century. Bird's research was recently featured in an exhibit here at the museum called Holidays on Display, and in a book of the same title.
My name is William Lawrence Bird, and I'm a curator in the Division of Political History at the National Museum of American History, and I've written a book about holidays and holidays on display. Well, the book is about the display business and the people in it who I consider to be artists. And when you look at, I'm really looking at it from the point of view of display as a creative livelihood in this country, especially during the heyday of the downtown department store and the local promotional economy of parades and annual celebrations and commemorative events that called for some kind of a elaborate decoration. And when you spend any time with this, you quickly realize that Christmas is the one time of the year when you as a display person have creative license to just go completely over the top in what would normally be considered to be a reasonable business expense. So, after the Second World War, between then and maybe about, I don't know, the mid-60s, it was a period when I was growing up as a kid, it's sort of my effort to sort of pay homage to this kind of over-the-top in a holiday display that I remember, being able to go downtown with your parents or your grandparents, and it was sort of an annual treat to see the windows, see the mechanical displays. And you sort of see it today in some pockets of pedestrian activity in New York and certainly along State Street in Chicago. But that's pretty much my inspiration in doing it. And of course, looking at it in a historic way, you can push the development back, of course, way before the beginning of the Second World War, back to the late 19th century when people began to develop these mechanical displays in store windows.
You mentioned New York and Chicago still having some of these downtown public spaces for things like this. But outside of that, probably a lot of people, when they see these kind of things now, it's at the mall and they see Santa set up and things like that. How does that compare with these downtown department store displays of the 50s and 60s, et cetera?
Well, in the 50s and 60s, and what I'm talking about is a retail economy that's on the cusp of sort of suburban expansion that began in the 1950s and was certainly carried out, you know, to great effect in the 60s, 70s, and on up to what we consider now. So on one end, you have these competitive downtown department stores that began as family operations, and they compete. They go head to head with each other in the downtown retail core. And then you begin to get some suburban expansion where they grow and they have other stores typically that anchor shopping malls. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have these big box retail discounters who really don't believe in display, certainly not as a business expense. And so they don't invest in it, and they proclaim that they're not going to do displays. They build stores that don't have any decorative effects in them at all, because it's just really about making things available to the customer at the point of purchase without any kind of impediment. And so you have the mall as sort of like the middle ground, you know, between these two economies, one which is lavish display downtown competing, the other is just a kind of a bare bones box that some display people would regard as soulless. Actually, they described it that way. But the mall is very different from either of those things, because it's usually developed in concert with an anchor store. And you don't really have the stores within the mall competing with each other in a way that you would in a traditional downtown retail setting where the stores are all independently owned. When you had stores that were independently owned, they would go way over the top in each one trying to become the destination, the retail institution, the leading retail institution in a particular town. Now, what you get are, they may be a leading retail destination, but they're part of a chain. And to a chain, what is one store in a town? I mean, it's like a parade float builder from Minnesota explained this to me one time. He said, you know, when he would go to sell the idea of a parade or even decorating a town, he would start off with the bank, you know, and go into the bank at Manitowoc or whatever. He says, you know, now, you know, that's now the Bank of America Manitowoc branch. It's no longer, you know, so they don't put the money into it the way that they once did it. And that's sort of the same way with the retail core. You know, you might have, say, a Macy's or a Boscov's in Pennsylvania, whatever you might have, but it's hardly competing with anything anymore. And so they don't really put as much into it in the way that they used to. And the mall tenants, they sort of defer to the chain that's managing the mall. They may go over the top and compete with another mall in building a greater Santa Land or something, but they pretty much do pretty much what you've come to expect. Mm-hmm.
Can you describe some of the ways that these stores competed with each other, some of the displays that they set up, some of the more lavish and interesting things that you've researched?
Well, one of the classic ones, and this was quite early in the 1920s, was the retailer John Wanamaker, whose anchor store was in Philadelphia, and he purchased the old Stewart store in New York. So he had two stores. He had one in Philadelphia, of course, which was really still wonderful today as a Macy's. But he went head-to-head with Macy's in New York City. And in the early 20s, for example, every day during the Christmas season, he would have a parade in the store. And it would bring Santa in and install Santa on the throne in the toy department. And there are pictures of this, you know, with people just having a parade in the store with a band and coming through. And sometimes they had live animal acts, but these sort of gradually came to be replaced by mechanical, you know, animated papier-mâché figures, which is a separate business in itself. But this was the setting in which the Macy Parade developed as an outdoor parade that you see today, run pretty much for the benefit by and for their employees that participate in the parade and make it happen as an all-volunteer effort. So, and after the success of the outdoor parade, that really sort of eclipsed anything that anybody was doing in the display world in New York City, with the exception of the windows that continue to be a draw for people. And really positions those stores as leading retail institutions. Well, let's say in the late 1890s, when you have somebody like Frank Baum, who before he became famous as a children's author, The Wizard of Oz, was the editor of a magazine that was called The Show Window in Chicago. And he kept tabs on who was doing what in the world of window display and also store interiors and theming, float work, you know, that all that kind of thing. Anything that was shiny, you know, and on the surface and lit with colored lights, he was very much into this, and certainly into mechanical displays as things that would stop people and attract attention and, you know, pull you into the store past all kinds of tempting stock, you know. So he would give awards to somebody who set up a Santa Land at the back of the store, you know, to pull people through the tempting stock to get out to the front of it. But that was sort of the idea behind having a Santa parade. I mean, as early as 1913, there are accounts that are published in the Show Window of, you know, a store in, you know, Kentucky or Tennessee or someplace, what they did to get people to their store, to become the destination, become the leading retail institution in their town. And they would have a Santa parade. the purpose of which was to announce the visual announcement of the arrival of Christmas and the opening of the holiday shopping season by having a parade. And guess where the destination at? What, it ended at the store. And it ended with, you know, Santa entering the store and declaring it open for business. I mean, it's really not too surprising how this gets going. But people had figured this out, you know, well before what you think of today as the parade in the from the 20s or, you know, up until recent. But it has sort of, today it's sort of transcended its original commercial impetus, I would argue. And it's become something that is in and of itself, has taken on a life of its own. You know, if, let's imagine, heaven forbid, that Macy's declared bankruptcy, there would still be a parade in New York City on Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. just as there is still a parade in Philadelphia that used to be run by Gimbel's. I mean, it might not be the most elaborate parade of memory, but there would still be a need for something that day that looked or at least resembled or paid homage to what was there, because it's become so much a part of people's lives that they expect it. And I thought if there was just a little bit of that emotional success or pull that I could put into this book, it would have succeeded. It would have, you know, resonated with people.
What about the actual holiday parades themselves? You mentioned someone specifically, Isabella Coleman. Can you talk about who she is and what her role is in this story?
Yeah, she is a Pasadena, California housewife. And when she was, and I mean, I say that not as a kind of a pejorative, but she regarded her display work as purely a voluntary kind of community-based effort, which I think is the trick. It's, well, it's not really a trick, but it's the basis of success. Any ongoing parade's continued success is dependent upon volunteer effort. You have sponsors, but believe me, you can't pay for what you see on the street in Pasadena, and you certainly can't pay for it to be seen on the street in New Orleans. I mean, there are costs involved. Mm-hmm. But Isabella Coleman, as a girl, grew up decorating floats for Pasadena school floats and parades. The schools all get involved in this. And one year she couldn't find a float to ride on. And so her parents said, well, why don't you take our horse and shay, that's a horse and a carriage, and make your own float and decorate it. And that hadn't occurred to her until they suggested it. So she, from her parents' garden, she took, you know, the marigolds and just wove them around the wheels and this kind of thing. And to her amazement, she won a prize in the parade. So after that, she was never without a float in the Tournament of Roses parade. And as an adult, she grew into this, it's a kind of a holiday business that maybe took up 3 or 4 months of the year. The rest of the time, year, she would just be, you know, a housewife. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until the Depression, when her banker husband lost his job, that she realized the only money in the family checking account was from her float work. I mean, she had these, you know, tens of thousands of dollars worth of contracts with, you know, Conoco Oil. I mean, with any kind of business enterprise would want one of her floats. And in terms of her innovative techniques, she was, her ideal float was low to the ground because people sat in chairs along the parade route, if not sitting on, you know, curbs. And so her ideal float was something that was very low to the ground, sort of like knee level of curbside spectators. And that's pretty much still the way that it is. And she hid the driver of these self-propelled floats, which were typically built on like an old school bus chassis or something, in a cockpit, and she used aircraft wheels, tiny wheels, so that the thing looked like it was just hovering mm-hmm. above the ground. In other words, floating. You know, the ideal float is sort of like a cloud, you know, right. coming down the street. And she was the one of the first to paste flower petals onto a steel undercarriage. And that was one of the reasons that the tournament arose as today. It's an all natural covering. You know, it's painted, a painted undercoating, but then the colors are followed out with, you know, nuts, seeds, any kind of grass, any has to be a natural covering. So it's sort of the floral parade. Right.
So it sounds like a lot of her ideas and things she came up with have become what we see in floats in the Rose Bowl, the Tournament of Roses parade today.
Exactly. I mean, she is a truly innovative person, but a lot of the things that you see would probably have come up with or without her, but she was there at the, you know, at the time and, you know, pushing things in a certain direction. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there are lots of stories associated with her. You know, the people who would be the marshals that come into the parade, for example, Walt Disney, when he met her, he said, "Oh, I've wanted to meet you, you know, for a long time. I'm a fan of, you know," I mean, he knew what he mm-hmm. was looking at, you know. And she kind of, you know, just mildly, you know, amused at the attention that she would get. And, but it wasn't for her, it wasn't a business for her. Every extra dime that she got, she put back into the product on the street. And mm-hmm. as floats were being developed, and she always had, you know, five or six in the parade, she would get ideas about which ones she thought might win a prize. And so extra things would go onto those floats. Things would be redirected. Resources would be apportioned. You know, you might want to put some orchids, you know, right. get some of that.
What sparked your interest in this topic? The topic of your book, Holidays on Display, was this personal experiences?
Or I think it was mostly personal experience, and I was sort of dismayed and disheartened that the museum didn't have anything on it, and I began to wonder about it. I mean, display is just such a natural topic for a museum. I mean, we think we do displays, and this is the kind of thing that people have an emotional attachment to. And certain memories, you know, associated with it. And so I began to find people that were in the business that I could meet and who would teach me the business. And there was a what really sort of pushed me toward it, though. The store that I went to as a boy was Woodward and Lothrop. It's an old-time Washington family-owned department store up at on F Street. It's now anchored by an H&M clothing store, if you're curious about where it is. But they had 13 windows along F Street and then turned the corner. That was an annual pilgrimage, an annual event. I mean, they had the combined daily attendance of passerbys rivaled the combined daily attendance of the Smithsonian Institution during holiday season. And when that store went bankrupt in the mid-90s, along with Wanamaker's in Philadelphia, they were part of that bankruptcy proceeding. They decorated the store one last time for Christmas, even though it was only October. And it was kind of like a goodbye, mm-hmm. you know. And they had a little flyer that they passed out, a little red flyer. It was a picture of a Christmas tree, and on the top was spiked with a jack-o'-lantern. He said, even though it's October, we decorated for Christmas one last time. And I thought that was sort of interesting. And the people going through it were, you know, like, gee, I thought that I would go bankrupt before they did. You know, how is this possible? And so once the store had closed, the real estate guy who owned the property, there's no tenant in the building. I mean, it's just an empty building with these big, you know, plate glass windows that are also empty. He set up a window in the corner, and it wasn't, you know, a great mechanical display or anything. It was, you know, a sleigh, and it had some snow and some trees and some little, as I remember, characters or something. And people came to see it. And to me, this is sort of like cargo culting, you know. I mean, this store isn't there anymore, but people kept coming to see it. And this went on for a couple of years. The store stayed vacant. And, you know, I kept reading accounts of this phenomenon in the paper, and I thought, you know, this is really something here. And one of the first people I interviewed had been the vice president for display at the store, and he kind of guided me, you know, through the business and told me about, you know, his, how he had gotten into it and what made it special, you know, for him. And that's when I realized, you know, the competitive nature of this and how, you know, there's an economy that no longer exists in cities. But what was once there resulted in this over the top kind of festivity that you look forward to every year, and people were still looking forward to it even though you couldn't the stores had left, you know.
Thanks to William Lawrence Bird for his time. For more information and more pictures, check out the book Holidays on Display. For the History Explorer podcast, I'm Matt Ringelstetter. Tune in again next month as we take another look at what goes on behind the scenes here at the National Museum of American History. Podcast made possible by a grant from the Verizon Foundation. Music by Nevada Vanderveer and provided by freemusicarchive.org.